This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Social condition, the one will openly visit. The atrocious revisions of our forefathers' decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
Everyone knows our civilization is doomed and our kids will be digging through the rubble for cans of dog food. Apparently, Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin missed the memo. He wrote the book Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow. Laughlin is the Bass Professor of Physics at Stanford University, where he has taught since 1985. In 1998, he shared the Nobel Prize for Physics. His previous books are Crime of Reason and A Different Universe. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I read the book. I've called Robert up to argue with him, and that's a big mistake because he's smarter than I am. And anyway, it's a trap. Robert Laughlin wants us to argue with him. Robert Laughlin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This should be fun.
It could be. The old saying, you know, is that you shouldn't jump to conclusions, but I think that's exactly what you started out doing by writing this book. Didn't you presume we will find the energy we need in the future and then try to figure out how?
I did. But, of course, you appreciate that some fraction of this text is black humor. I myself think that the transition from here to there is very likely to be quite awful. But I decided that I could target a business audience better if I skipped that and talked about what's eventually going to happen, because the correct thinking about what to do begins with what will be.
Well, as I told you, Robert, in email, I stewed over this book thinking, well, he hasn't counted on an economic crash, and where is the climate damage? What is your response to that?
Oh, I think both are very likely to happen. But my timing is a little different from most people concerned about the climate. I think that the energy shortages are likely to happen first. And so that's where I put my emotional energy. It's behind that part of the problem. Now, the damage that you're doing to the environment is real. It's harder to measure, so harder to get consensus on it. But everybody knows the CO2 is going up, and that has implications.
But you just decided to bypass that and said, all right, well, what would the future look like anyway? Is that right?
I did. Well, you see, we live in the middle of a grand mal political dysfunctional conversation about this, that it has to do with the difficulty of understanding things. So you've got one set of people who think doom is upon us in less than a century, and you have another set of people who think the doom is not upon us and the whole thing is a fiction. Now, I look at the facts and I see something in between. So I think that the human race dying off completely isn't what's going to happen. I do think that a lot of it could have trouble. So the right-wing view that there is going to be no trouble, I don't think is correct. And I also don't think that the end of the human race is correct. When there isn't enough of something, what human beings usually do is fight over it. So what I tell people when I'm in talks about this is that what we're really discussing is the safety of your progeny, whether they're going to have to fight or not. And you have to decide whether you want to invest now to protect them. They don't exist yet. In fact, they won't exist for many decades. They haven't been born. So, and you'll be gone by that time. So the question is whether you want to act now to help them or not.
So let's say we give you and humanity the benefit of those rather large doubts you've expressed. You do presume that oil and gas and even coal will run out. We all know that's going to happen. And I want to talk to you about the energy solutions that we might employ. But first, I think you need to tell us a little bit more about what power really is, and it's not just what comes out of the wall socket. I was impressed about your discussion of how little power there really is in a transmission line at any one time. Do you want to talk to us about how finely balanced that system is?
Sure. This is, of course, technicalities about the electric lines. Electric lines, by their nature, are simply transmission lines, like hydraulic lines. And the way they work is that somewhere on the other end of them, where you can't see, there's a generator somewhere. And the fact that you plugged in your apparatus or switched on your light, that information propagates backwards down the line at the speed of light and shows up as an extra load on the generator. and then the people who are manning the generator then adjust it so to keep the line voltage up. So this is an aspect of electricity that a lot of people don't understand, that it really is fossil fuel. Electricity is not different from fossil fuel. Somewhere at the other end of the line is the generator. You just can't see it. This, in turn, affects the whole conversation about the wind and sun. Why? Well, because electricity is valuable because you can get it when you want it. And right now, this is only possible because the people at the other end have a big tank of fossil fuel that they can burn whenever they wish. When you start talking about the wind and sun, that's not true, because the wind and sun are intermittent. They don't come when you call. We know from electricity events in the past that the true market value of electricity varies by a factor of over 10 between high demand and low demand. In other words, the electricity that you're willing to pay for most is the electricity you can't get. And that is, for example, on a very hot day when you just must have the air conditioner on. So the whole idea of replacing the electricity supply with renewable sources has this little problem with it, that it can't work without a massive storage apparatus. And this apparatus does not yet exist.
Well, that does apply, because if we got, you know, the late night talk show host Jay Leno out talking with Americans, as you pointed out in your book, I doubt he could find anyone who's heard of Andesol 1. What is that, and why is it too bad Americans don't know about it?
This is a solar plant in Spain built by a German company based on principles that were made in USA. So it's kind of a fascinating three-ring circus. I stumbled upon the facts of it as a side effect of writing this book. The astonishing thing is that it's not in the U.S. press at all, but it is in the European press. This is one of the great disadvantages Americans have of being monolingual. Why it has no press in this country, I'm a little baffled by. There are, as of this moment, 11 such plants built. They're not that big, 50 megawatts, but it's clear Spanish capitalists decided that it was workable and decided to fund them. There are more, actually. They're happening quietly in places like Morocco. Now, what's so neat about it is that they licked the storage problem. I was writing this book, and I said, well, everyone knows you can't store electricity except by pumping water uphill, but I checked it. And what I discovered is I was wrong, that nobody bothered to tell these German guys, so they just did it. Now, it is specifically designed for the sun and specifically designed for solar thermal, which, as you know, has got problems, at least in North America, problems that are caused, who knows, probably by Chinese currency shenanigans. But in any event, they certainly have problems. Well, thinking this through, I realized that you could do it with the wind, too. And not only that, but it's by far the best way to actually do it.
And what is that storage?
Well, you do it with heat. And now we have the catch-22 of being a technical man. You see, it came in a flash to me that you could do this, so I made a patent. And right now, I'm busy trying to get the capital together to do it. It turns out I'm a doer. And so you see a problem, you fix it. This particular issue, of course, is complicated by the divvying up of the energy markets. Alternate energy is always complicated because it involves government subsidies, and those are always a little dirty. And the amount of money that you have to cough up to be serious about electricity is very large. However, the technical specs came rolling out, and it's straightforward. I'm enough convinced that it's the right solution to the problem that I'm putting my own hours and cycles on it now. And with luck, pray for me that we get the dollars to line up. By God, I can do it.
Well, you know, I think our listeners are still wondering, well, what did they do at Andesol 1? I mean, what's the secret?
Oh, good point. Well, when you're storing energy, the short answer is they put the energy in heat, and they stored it in salt. Why salt? No particular reason, except that it's really runny. And it turns out, for getting the heat in and out, you want something that's not viscous. It's really runny, and it's molten in the region, the temperature region, that is high but not so high that it melts steels. There is a large literature on this whole subject that comes out of the nuclear reactor industry, it turns out. So the use of salts is for heat media is well known. So what these folks did is they borrowed the design concept of Solar 2 and actually scaled it up and built it as a way to stash the energy. So the idea is that you heat up some medium with the energy. You put the energy in the form of heat, and then you stash that. You sort of stash this hot stuff. And then when you're ready to make electricity out of it, you pull the hot stuff out of it and run a turbine with it. Now, the thing that's important about these plants that happened in Spain is that they got the economics right. So you know that the fact that it multiply deployed means that you've got a cost structure there that makes sense, with the proviso that the Spanish government had very high guaranteed prices for the electricity made. That's, of course, always a bone of contention. But the point is all those costs are laid out enough that you know what they are. And they're rather wonderful, actually. What my friends and I figured out was that if you chopped off the solar field and just made the storage by itself, the cost goes way down, and what you've got is functionally a battery. But a battery that isn't environmentally hazardous, and it wears like iron, and it's real cheap. Now, I'm sorry, I'm getting too excited because this is my favorite subject. But anyway, did I answer your question?
You sure did. And I liked your answer, and I want to buy one of your batteries. So you got me. Now, in your book, Powering the Future, you also describe a planet with a very cold, dark surface under tremendous pressure where we could develop using robotic technology, but we don't need any spaceships. Where is that, and what could we do there?
Oh, that's right here on Earth. That's at the bottom of the ocean. You appreciate that this chapter I wrote before any of the BP disasters at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico occurred. So I knew that there were lots of advanced robotics used at the bottom of the ocean by the oil industry. And I wanted to talk about that as part of the larger vision. Lots of people want to stash energy at the bottom of the ocean. And so I wanted to put some numbers on that and sort of to explain how you would do it. My guess is that actually it'll be too expensive, okay, to do that, and that it'll wind up centuries from now being stashed on the surface of the Earth, and my bet says heat. However, if you wanted to put it at the bottom of the ocean, out of sight, out of mind, it's perfectly doable because the means you have are there. The neat thing is the instrumentalities for doing it are not your own bodies. They can't be because human beings can't take the pressure down there, and they never will be able to. The pressure vessels you need to protect yourself are just too bulky and unwieldy and expensive. However, robots have no problem with it. And if you saw the movies of the wellhead of Deepwater Horizon getting fixed by robots, and you know that these robots are pretty neat, and they're perfectly happy down there in this horribly high pressure, horribly cold environment. So the future sort of is already here. It's just not in the public consciousness. Oil people use these robotics daily, and the people who drive them are on the surface basically with artificial bodies at the bottom of the ocean doing work.
I was intrigued with your explanation of deep sea air pressure storage of energy, and then I thought, well, could we do it with carbon dioxide instead and maybe solve two problems in one?
Sure. In fact, people are talking about that. It's hypersensitive, of course, because lots of people who want sequestration of carbon dioxide, what they really want is you don't make the carbon dioxide in the first place. So there's a literature on this, and people are discussing putting it down there. The carbon dioxide will absorb very nicely down the bottom of the ocean. But then you've polluted the bottom of the ocean. Right? So do you really want to do that? So there are people on both sides of that issue. Sequestration of carbon is incredibly politicized conversation, in part because it affects the coal industry. So if I can put this in perspective a little bit, you've asked about deep sea sequestration of carbon, and absolutely you can do it. But there's a piece of the conversation that comes before that, which is, well, whose carbon dioxide are you putting down there? It turns out the only carbon dioxide that you're talking about is from coal plants. It's from exhaust from power plants. About a third of the energy budget, maybe more, depending on how you reckon it, is from transport. And we're not talking about putting that carbon dioxide at the bottom because it's too expensive to do it. You only need the CO2 that's concentrated, and that comes out of power plants. So that means that the sequestration conversation is kind of only about half of it. And the problem I have with all of this is that people don't understand that this is such a big problem that solving, getting rid of half of it does nothing. You have to stop it all, or you've done nothing. And the reason why is because it's cumulative. When you're talking about stopping carbon from getting into the air, the conversation you need to have is about the carbon that you didn't capture. You see what I'm saying? So it turns out at least a third of that is intractable, and that is from cars. One of the things you worry about is that this whole conversation might be implicitly about something else, which is warfare between the natural gas and coal industries. Coal industries want to keep their business. The natural gas people want to take it. And one of the grounds on which they take it is that they make a lot less CO2 than the coal people do per amount of energy that you use. Since all this stuff is highly political and somewhat secretive, I can't weigh in on what I think the answer is. I'll tell you and your listeners to just be on the lookout for stuff that doesn't make sense, because there might be a landmine there.
Good warning. Well, Robert B. Laughlin, you're an award-winning professor of physics. Usually the physicists I talk to like nuclear power as a solution. Some even love it with a passion. Where do you fit in that spectrum?
A little background that'll help you understand this. It turns out I'm one of the few physicists you will meet who spent time behind the fence. So I have education in not only things nuclear, but things nuclear that have to do with warfare. Now, with that revealed, my take on nuclear power is that it's political. In other words, that because of the history of nuclear power, it's publicly owned, functionally publicly owned. It has to do in the United States with the Atomic Energy Act, but it's true in all countries. So nuclear power is different from fossil power. It's a public decision, whereas fossil power is a private decision. Now, the way the winds are blowing right now is that the public is pretty evenly split about nuclear power. And that means we've got ambiguity. So the German vote was awfully close, and I actually called it the other way. But then I didn't count on the Japanese having the second worst nuclear disaster in all of history. And that swung it just over the edge. And so it went the other way. The thing I say as a sort of peripatetic scientist is that you have to understand that nuclear energy is fossil energy. It's not carbon fossil energy, but it's definitely fossil in that it's from fuel that's in the Earth's crust that you're burning up. And the amount of it in the crust is finite. Now, exactly how much there is, you have to estimate. There's quite a lot, actually. But you ask how many years we're talking. Well, not much, okay? The amount of uranium-235 in the crust estimated by the IAEA is about the same amount of energy as the coal in the Earth's crust. That means if you sort of keep going the way you're going, the two crises come at the same time, historically, about two centuries out, where the coal runs out and the uranium runs out at the same time. You can make the uranium last longer by doing breeding. People don't like breeding, though, because there's an engineering hook on it, which is the reactors are more dangerous. So you'll find that the whole nuclear conversation is mixed up with the fossilness of the nuclear supplies, with the danger of radiation and how you risk that, and also national security of various countries. For example, the Indians have about 40% of the world's thorium. So right as of this moment, the Indian government loves nuclear power, and they're designing thorium reactors. Well, the fine print there is that all of these reactors are breeders. You have to make a breeder reactor with thorium, and that means that all of the planned thorium burners that the Indians have on the table have potential safety problems. Now, that's not stopping them, but you have to sort of wait until something happens before you really will know what the public policy is in India. As of this moment, the nation that uses the most nuclear power is the USA, by a lot. France has a bigger proportion of its electricity generated by nuclear power, but it's a smaller country. So the big nuclear power user is the USA, followed by France and Japan. what I'm hearing from colleagues in China is that they have decided to go nuclear. They haven't been dissuaded at all by the Fukushima accident. And in fact, students we have here from Kazakhstan report that their regularly trains, all the uranium ore trains that used to go up to Moscow are now going east to China. So my take on the nuclear stuff is that it's complicated, it's political, there are pros and cons, and no, it won't save you for tens of thousands of years. That's nonsense.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Nobel laureate and Stanford physics professor Robert B. Laughlin. We're talking about his book, Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow. Robert, you write, after the coal runs out, nuclear power will battle it out with solar power. What's the matter with solar power?
It's just cost. Now, you say just cost. The history of energy use by advanced countries has always been a story of cutthroat competition. That's the way it's always been, and that's the explanation for why it's relatively cheap. You see, something so important to you, you'd expect that the market value would be really high. But it's also the case that there's a lot of supply, and the suppliers are busy trying to get your business, and so that brings the price down to what you can bear. Now, all of the alternate energy conversations that one has must start from that. The fundamental reality of the energy market is that it's hyper-competitive, and that people are busy making warfare on each other and destroying each other's companies on the basis of very tiny profit margins. So the technical means to make the energy that you need exist. We talk about the total amount of sunlight raining down on the Earth. It's way in excess of what you need to save civilization. This is one of the reasons that most physicists are optimistic about the future. When people get desperate enough, they can do it. You can do it technically. To me, there's no question that the energy supplies will be there when you need them, and that civilization in the long run will be okay. Human beings will be okay, and they'll have the energy supplies they need to live. What is not so clear is whether you're going to burn up all the coal and oil first. The present trajectory is, my read on it, is that one will. It's a matter of timing what will happen. Now, I talk about the battling out of nuclear power. This is designed to shock people, especially my friends who are so anti-nuclear, they can't see straight. They say, well, let's just use the sun. Well, I say, well, thank you very much, people, but what you have to understand is that all human beings are selfish. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect those people of the future to vote for power that's five times more expensive to save the Earth. What I mean by reasonable is I don't think they'll do it. My experience with things political is it's much easier for people to invent a fiction about why what they're doing is right than it is to do the actual right thing. So I could easily see the anti-nuclear movement of today getting turned around in the future by people who are desperate for power, because they just do a little calculation. All they have to do is rewrite history. It doesn't require any money, and the electricity bills fall by a factor of five, and you just declare that nuclear energy was the right thing to use all along, and that those people of the past were deluded. Well, unfortunately, that's what often happens in political situations when people get tighted. So, yeah, I think that even though nuclear energy is on the ropes right now, you have to look at the future very realistically and think, what will happen? What's going to happen when the fossil supplies begin to flag and there's a price competition? What are your great-great-grandchildren actually going to do? And I think you need to take seriously the possibility that they'll just revise your worldview and burn up all the uranium.
I agree that people are greedy, but they also have other emotions, and one of them is fear. And what I'm seeing now in the nuclear industry is that nobody's really changed very much after Fukushima. We've still got the same sort of dangerous reactors. I think there's 23 of those Mark I's running in the United States right now. So all we need is a couple more explosions, and then we need some time to see how many people get sick from it. Maybe people will, out of fear, rewrite that history and not go there.
No, they might. Let me tell a little story. I was in Germany, I'm going to say 2 years ago, and I was talking with a high-level ministerial person at a dinner. And I said, I just written a book about energy, and there's a chapter on nuclear energy in it. She says, well, we're trying to get rid of nuclear energy. And I said, okay, that means more Russian natural gas. Whereupon she changed the subject. Now, I relate this story to my German friends. They get a big smile on their face because they know what's going on here. That there is denial on the part of people that the reason you can talk about getting rid of nuclear energy is that there are cheap alternatives. In fact, the energy bill would probably go down if you got rid of the nuclear reactors because they're kind of expensive compared to the fossil fuels. Germany, you know, is a big coal burner, so that's another part of the calculus that's rather complicated. But the whole conversation about how energy is conserved and that you don't have immaculate conception of it, and that if you shut down one source of it, you have to get the energy from somewhere else. The conversation is so dysfunctional that you can't talk about that. You're going to shut down the nuclear reactors, but where is the energy going to come from? We live in an era where the actual energy itself is still really cheap. In fact, it's arguably the cheapest it's ever been, especially in natural gas sector in the USA. And so an anti-nuclear conversation is really a pro-gas conversation. And most people are okay with that because natural gas is mostly hydrogen, and so it's not as big a carbon problem as the other stuff. But that begs the issue that it's going to run out, not tomorrow, but eventually it'll run out. Whereupon, what are you going to do? Therefore, I think that the real conversation about nuclear energy hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet, and it won't happen until things get tight in the oil and gas market. Then the conversation will get earnest because it will be then the trade-off not between nuclear energy and cheap gas, but nuclear energy and very, very, very expensive electricity. That's a different conversation.
I hate to agree with you, but I think that gas is really problematic. First of all, fracked gas, there have been studies out showing that there's enough leakage in the whole process, including the delivery and storage system, that you might as well be burning coal. So it's not that great a solution anyway once you start fracking for it. And the second thing is that they have to keep drilling more and more and more and more wells because gas runs out so quickly. It doesn't just sort of decline the way an oil well does. It's there, and then it's not there, and that could happen to the whole darn industry. So we may be in for a shock on this gas dependence.
It might. That anecdotal rumors that I'm hearing, yes, are that the fracked wells peak more rapidly than the traditional deep wells do. Traditional deep wells of gas are like oil wells. They have long peaking tails. But it's very hard to back up this short peaking story with data because the industry is too young. So I think it's right, but I'm not 100% sure. Fracking has opposition, political opposition from various sources, and you're quite right. There are environmental issues, and there's how much methane you're putting in the air, and so on. And so that's a conversation we have, whether you're going to have laws that regulate the use of natural gas. Those are conversations are now happening. But in North America, at least, what has happened is that natural gas is so cheap that nobody's fracking for it anymore. They can't make money. So the fracking activity for gas has basically come to a screeching halt because the market price of gas went down to one half of what it should have been, what it was before, and the drillers can't make money. All those people have now gone off into what's called the tight oil market, and they are trying to go back to old wells that have pooped out and use these new technologies to pull out the remaining oil from the reservoirs there. Because of the political lay of the land, this is something I think that's just going to work out, and we'll see. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's infinite gas in the ground, and they can just keep drilling, and everybody will be energy independent forever because of the gas. I suppose it's possible. But my money says that this is a fantasy. My guess is that it's a fantasy, and what will happen is that there'll be a 10 to 20 year peaking tail associated with these new technologies that will then poop out, and then sort of towards the middle of the century, one will be back to where one was in the early 90s.
Well, in the end, however many years from now, your future humans have electricity and cars and airplanes simply because we love them so much. And as an environmentalist, I was really annoyed by such blatant assumptions until I came to think, well, you're creating a kind of public mirror. That is what we all think. At least that's the way the government acts. And if we're honest, even environmentalists, they buy cars they hope will last 20 years without too many repair bills. So maybe it's time to come clean a little bit, Robert Laughlin. Is this book, Powering the Future, a little bit like Jonathan Swift's essay, A Modest Proposal? Are you baiting us a little?
I don't think so. I'm asking people who are really worried, you know, who love the Earth as I do, to think realistically about what's going to happen. There are a lot of people, especially in the 20 crowd, you know, the student crowd, who think that the world is coming to an end and that you have to make drastic changes in governance in order to stop it. Now, what I try to tell these folks is that after you've lived a long time, what you see is that the human nature comes out of the box. You don't program that. It's people come out of the box where they are, and so you're great-grandchildren who don't exist yet are going to be like you, and they're going to love life, and they're going to, when they do this living, they're going to be a burden on the Earth just like you are, and they're going to have to make environmental compromises just like you do, and this is a conversation of all eternity. In other words, you're not going to pass a law tomorrow and save the Earth. Saving the Earth is an ongoing process that will go thousands and millions of years into the future. Every generation that's born will have to make economic compromises between how well it lives and how much you protect the Earth. There's no quick fix. I want everybody to think about the future in terms of both natural law and the laws of economics. When I talk to student audiences around the world, I typically ask them three questions. I ask them, in this time in the future, after all the fossil fuel is gone, will people drive cars? Will people drive flying airplanes? And will the electricity come on? And it turns out that almost universally around the world, the answer is more or less the same. About 70% of the people say that folks will drive cars. And I ask them why, and it beats around the bush for 10 minutes, and then somebody, usually a young woman, says quietly, because they want them. Whereupon we have a conversation about economics. The fact that some of the things that are destined to happen will occur simply because people want them. And that's something, when you're thinking about actions you must do to save the Earth, that's something you have to think about. Okay? People who are not born yet are going to do things just because they want them. The airplane conversation comes down similarly, about 70%. And there, I ask them, great, why? It's the same answer. And then I ask, well, what's going to fuel the airplanes? And then we have all sorts of silly conversations about sunlight and so forth. And then we hit on the important thing, which is that, well, present-day jet fuel has the most energy per volume and weight allowed by physical law. And so if those people of the future are going to be flying in airplanes, then we're not going to have a carbon-free future. What we're going to have instead is a new industry that grows up that makes the kinds of fuels that you use today from parts that are lying around. This, of course, doesn't pull any more carbon out of the Earth anymore, so there's no CO2 issue there. But there is a matter that you can't demonize carbon completely, per se, when you're thinking about the future, because there will always be carbon-based fuels in the future because they're optimal. And then the final thing is the electricity coming on, and that's an important matter which has to do with politics. That is to say that there are pricing things likely to happen in the future that are dictated by what people will vote for. That means that in particular, this fight I mentioned about the solar energy versus nuclear taking place, there probably isn't any way to revert that because the political process demands that power be cheap. So once we have that conversation, then we can go and talk about the getting from here to there.
Of course, you're presuming we will have a working political decision where people can vote for things. If we get knocked back far enough on our keisters, we might not be able to make those decisions, especially the big-scale decisions, but we can debate that. I do want to bring up the last 81 pages of the book. These are endnotes, and they're a bit daunting. Some seem to require a science degree to be understood. Others point to research we should all be doing. I'm wondering if somebody actually followed up on those 470 references. Shouldn't they get a degree or something?
I've had interesting feedback from people about those. One fellow wrote and he said, well, I enjoyed the book until I got to those notes. Why did you put all this burden on me and have all these notes there? My editor said, well, this is the best piece of scholarship I ever saw. The real answer here is that I decided to do that to protect myself from political attack. You probably noticed that this is a highly politicized subject, and whenever you make public speech about energy, you're bound to be attacked by somebody, either on the right or the left, even if you're right. So what I decided to do was to put a little bit of armor in the back there. So anybody attacks me for being wrong, I can hammer them into the ground. And what has happened, curiously, is that no one has dared, because stripped of the references, the rhetoric could be spun as meaning you're making apologies for oil companies, or it could mean that you're a crazy left-wing climate person. Now, what I think is that when scholars, people who are professors, talk about energy, you have to zero out all that political stuff. And when I say something is true, there's why. And you're welcome to go check it if you want, or not, as the case may be, but I'm not making stuff up. When I say a thing, I worry that what I've said is wrong, and I go check it. And when I found that I'm right, I document that I was.
I think there's a lot of good things in there. I intend to go diving into some of them. Well, as we wrap up, Robert Laughlin, is there other things that you would like to mention or talk about?
You know, when you write a book, you try to talk about everything you can think of in the prose itself. It's not the world's best medium because people can't talk back to you. In this particular case, the references in the back made feedback from people difficult, okay, that people are afraid to talk to me about it because it's got too much gravity. So I guess my answer to you and your listeners would be that I am not a lion. I love talking about this stuff. I'm as worried as anybody, and I'm trying to find what you might say is the way of the engineer. I am a person who looks at a terrible problem and asks, how do you fix it? And I'm a man also who answers his email. So anybody who wants to talk to me about it, feel free.
I'll challenge you, listeners, should you buy a book knowing it will irritate you or may make you think, and what if it educates you along the way? That is Powering the Future, How We Will Eventually Solve the Energy Crisis and Fuel the Civilization of Tomorrow, by Stanford physics professor and Nobel laureate Robert B. Laughlin. And he's been our guest on Radio EcoShock. You can find links to the book and other notes in my blog at ecoshock.info. Robert, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.